Welcome to Fanti, the podcast for all those complex and complicated conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am journalist and writer Jared Hill.
And I am the ebony enchantress Trayvell Anderson. Coming up on the show today, we're joined by the legendary Keith Boykin to talk about y'all's little government. We'll get into that later. But first, we have a very special edition of Pass the Popcorn. Typically, this is our segment to, you know, revisit, to chat a little deeper about the foolishness y'all are talking about in these social media streets. But this time, on this episode only, I'm renaming Pass the Popcorn. Remember that time? The White Supremacy edition.
Okay. First of all, that's not what we talked about in the meeting, but turn up. Get your life.
It is what it is, okay? Just go with it. So what we're going to do is, obviously, that man and his family are leaving the White House, okay? He is relinquishing the nuclear codes, praise the Lord, all right? And we theoretically are getting somebody better equipped to handle this, you know, parallelogram that we are in, okay? And so,
I'm sorry, the what?
The parallelogram.
The who?
You never heard of the parallelogram? We've been in it for months now.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Ponderosa. Okay, I get it. Go ahead on.
Anyway, in this edition of Remember That Time, the White Supremacy edition, I'd like us to take a walk down memory lane, revisiting some of our favorite moments of the Donald Trump presidency.
Let's also include that there's like a major asterisk next to the word favorite, right? Like the way that we're using that word.
These are the moments that, right, we should say, right, that made us laugh, made us scratch our head, made us go, what the hell?
Sure, I'll go with that. All right, so first things first, I think that one of my favorite things that I've enjoyed throughout the Trump administration has been all of the video of Melania swatting away his hand.
This is not a Taye Diggs movie, sir. You a grown man. Carry your ass on home now.
It's been so good.
It's been a delight amidst a terror, right? Like, I think watching Melania, like, rebuff him has been a little bit of a light for me.
Yeah, it's always good because I feel like you never expect it. And it also feels like he never expects it.
I want you to leave. And don't forget to go when you leave.
Okay, yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. And so,
that's the real problem.
I mean, I'm sure, at least based on this type of behavior, we'll likely see some sort of divorce proceedings in the near future. But also, maybe not.
Well, I mean, it'll be interesting to see because there's plenty of rumor mill that Melania did not, that Melania signed like a post-nup to come to the White House. I've not like heard that verified, but that's like definitely like a lot of the conversation around like why she took so long to come. But anyway, okay. You have one that's number two.
For me, I remember, y'all remember when Trump had all them fast food burgers, it was like McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's, and he served them in the White House. And I think it was for the Clemson Tigers. Don't get me talking about sports, as y'all know.
Their football team.
But the sport ball people had won some sort of award or some game.
Ball people.
And they, you know, got invited to the White House. But because the government was on friggin' shutdown, there wasn't a kitchen staff to prepare food. And so what did he do? He ordered some Baconators, okay?
Was it McDonald's that they ordered?
It was a variety.
Or was it like a bunch of stuff? Because I just remember seeing like boxes stacked up on each other of like Big Macs and other shit. And thinking to myself like, don't nobody want this cold fast food? Like, first of all, that part. But like, I didn't come to the White House to eat fast food.
And like, everybody knows, right, that like McDonald's fries is only good hot. Okay.
Listen, and I mean, if you're a McDonald's fries person, you know that, like, period, as your hand just did for me. Okay, I remember during the 2016 campaign, he was out, according to our notes, he was in Redding, which I didn't realize, Northern California, but like, there was a black person in the audience to which he shouted out, "Look at my African American." And I remember thinking, like, sis, you don't even hear you, do you? Like, you can't even catch what you sound like right now.
I want to know, I feel like we still didn't get that interview with said African American
who
was in the audience. Like, I need that footage. I mean, it probably was Herman Cain, rest in peace.
Anyway,
one of my favorite.
Listen, I'm sorry, Herman Cain jokes are always going to be a little bit funny, even though they should not be. I just want to acknowledge that.
One of my favorite moments was actually like a tangential. It isn't even about politics at all. For all my fans of Project Runway out there, as you know, Carly Kloss is the new host, right? And she, I think, is married to or dating one of the Kushner siblings or something like that.
If I'm not mistaken, she's married to Jared Kushner's brother, I think.
That sounds right.
You guys will correct me on Twitter.
And one of the contestants on the show was like just getting, you know, his behind handed to him for a horrible outfit or whatever. And they were like, oh, I can never see Carly wearing this outfit out. And the contestant was like, not even to dinner with the Kushners. It was like one of those subtle jabs that like made your jaw drop. It was just like, ooh, yeah. Like, get her, Jade. That's another Drag Race reference, but it was just so good to me.
That's definitely one of those things that you say on a reality show and you're like, oh, so you don't give a fuck about anything
like
anymore.
You want to go home.
Right. You ready to go.
Which he did go home.
Well, there's that. I actually watched that season. I started back into Project Runway since COVID, and I really enjoyed it. I watched that one. What's the Amazon one that Heidi
Klum? Next Plume in Line and, or something? Oh, no, Making the
Next
Cut.
Next in Fashion was the Netflix one, yeah. Which was fine. Making the Cut, I watched all of those. It was really good. So one of the other things that I thoroughly enjoyed in a way that...
You shouldn't have.
I'm not fully comfortable with, but the truth is the truth, it was a Wednesday night when the headline came across the television that Hope Hicks had COVID. And then a couple of hours later, it was Donald Trump has been quarantined with Melania in the residence. And then a couple hours later, it was, honey, the girl has COVID. And I remember thinking to myself, like, God, are you this good? Because after the year that we've had, Jesus, I just need you to show me that you will do what you said you would.
Yes.
Mind you, didn't. But Trump getting COVID was just mind-boggling to me. But it was also like such an obvious development after the way that they've handled COVID all year.
I mean, they were literally fooling all of them. And that brings me to one of my moments, which I feel like we have to mention. I feel like when we critique and talk about Donald Trump in this presidency, we don't talk enough about Mike Pence, right? And the ways in which he has emboldened the foolishness and supported it. And so I just have to give, this is a preemptive honorable mention, if you will, for the fly that landed on Pence's head during the debate, okay?
Baby, when I tell you that moment, so one of the things that I love that's come out of that is people have kept asking Kamala Harris if she could see the fly. And she every time I've seen her answer, I think I've seen her ask this twice. She just gets quiet and just kind of nods. Like, it is a delight for me. I love that moment. That she's like, of course I saw that damn fly and I didn't say shit. Okay. Headline from the Washington Post, Trump lets an 11-year-old boy mow the White House lawn. Now, I was fascinated by this story. One, because I thought like, oh, this is one of those cool things that presidents do to be able to have like a cool moment with a kid. What I loved about the moment, though, is the photo that came out of it, because there's the little boy and he's playing with, he's got the lawnmower and I think he's in the Rose Garden, if I'm not mistaken. But like, you see this photo of Trump trying to talk to him and the little boy gives no fucks about Donald Trump. He is like happily mowing this lawn and like Trump is like walking alongside. Little boy, don't give a fuck.
He's like, where's my check? Like, what are you
doing?
He's
like, sis, this free child labor at the White House? The devil is a lie.
Speaking of grass, the Four Seasons, was it the Four Seasons landscaping company that they ended up booking instead of the actual hotel? Like, this was a few weeks ago, I guess maybe a few months ago at this point.
Well, a couple months ago now, yeah.
But, like, how do you not, like, really? Like, it was just another example of, like, the stupidity coming out of this White House. Somebody did it on purpose. I just know somebody did it on purpose.
Well, there's a comedian on Instagram named Meg Salter, and I'll try to remember to put it in our Insta story on Thursday morning. She does this video where she pretends she is the girl who booked the Four Seasons, and it is hilarious. It was just one of those moments where you're like, these people are so incompetent that they don't even know how incompetent they are, and it was really frustrating to watch that, but also incredibly entertaining. One of the things that I loved out of this was... when Donald Trump enacted the Muslim ban, I loved watching the way Americans responded to it. We saw all this video of, like, lawyers on the floor with their laptops in airports working hard to be able to get people to be able to get into the country. And it was one of those moments where it was like, oh, the people will resist the bullshit if they can. And so I really, really appreciated that moment. It felt like you can do what you gonna do, but we gonna do everything that we can. And I loved that.
And last but not least, I feel like we have to give this last spot to you.
Okay. the Melania Trump plagiarism scandal. Yes.
Yes.
A moment that treated me quite kindly. And oddly enough, I was in a meeting just before we got on the air here, and I started getting tweets and text messages from folks that apparently this bullshit 1776 commission report that they put out trying to deny slavery and all that, apparently they plagiarized like a large swath of that. So anytime they've done anything kind of like that, people start texting and tweeting me. And that happened. So yeah, the plagiarism scandal, probably my favorite moment of the last 5 years when it comes to the Trumps. But yeah, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So thank you very much to Melania Trump. And actually, really interesting tea about that. I've been reading her best friend's book, Melania and Me, from Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, about working in the White House. And one of the most interesting things that came out of reading that book, other than hearing them talk about me, was them talking about how after that plagiarism scandal, Melania wasn't angry, she was suspicious. And they kind of imply that they think Ivanka might have actually been the reason that it was... that
get them, Ivanka. Yeah, although you don't get too much kudos either, sis.
Also, yeah, fuck her too. Okay, really quickly before we go to break, we got to get in our Dionne Warwick update. This has been something that I've just... Thank you for that. The ticker tape of Dionne Warwick information. My favorite tweet from her in the past few days has been... I just asked my team what the Busset challenge was. Why are you asking me to do that? Don't make me delete TikTok before I even start. And I don't know what that emoji is, but it's the one that I love seeing all the time. What do you call that?
It's like the one with the sick face is what I look. It's like not the green one, but the one with the weird
mouth. Yeah, exactly. I love that. So shout out to Dionne Warwick. We really want to have you on the show. We got to figure out how to make that happen.
Alrighty, beautiful people, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, it's time to talk about how white supremacy is all over the damn place.
Oh.
Be right back.
Welcome back to Fireside Chat on KMAX. With me in studio to take your calls is the dopest duo on the West Coast, Oliver Wong and Morgan Rhodes. Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm looking for a music podcast that's insightful and thoughtful, but like also helps me discover artists and albums that I've never heard of.
Yeah, man. Sounds like you need to listen to Heat Rocks every week. Myself, and I'm Morgan Rhodes, and my co-host here, Oliver Wong, talk to influential guests about a canonical album that has changed their lives.
Guests like Moby, Open Mike Eagle, talk about albums by Prince, Joni Mitchell, and so much more.
Yo, what's that show called again?
Heat Rocks, deep dives into hot records.
Every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Hey, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks.
These are real podcast listeners, not actors. We took the identifying marks off this podcast. Just tell me your impressions.
It's really sexy.
My first thought is like Radiolab?
Definitely something popular.
Yeah, really popular. A hit show.
But funny too. Like, does Tina Fey have a podcast?
Or the Marx Brothers?
Yeah, is this podcast Radiolab, but hosted by the Marx Brothers?
And sexy, like Sade. It reminds me of Sade.
Exactly. And they're all riding in a BMW.
Close, but not quite. Take a look behind these panels. And then watch this rocket blast off into space.
Whoa.
Ooh.
And there's the pies we made you.
Oh.
Now, let's show you the podcast.
Oh. Wow, it was Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
Hold on.
Whoa.
Ooh.
Oh, my goodness.
That was 514 J.D. Power & Associates Podcasting Awards.
That was really scary.
But compelling.
I guess I should definitely subscribe to Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Yeah. I'd say so.
Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
Welcome back to Fans High. I want to let you know this part of this episode is being recorded on Wednesday afternoon following the presidential inauguration of Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. It has been an interesting morning as we watched Donald Trump leave the White House on Marine One and make his way to Florida and hopefully into obscurity. But as we watched the inauguration, I couldn't help but think about the conversation we were going to be having for this week's show about white supremacy. We've heard a lot of conversation around the domestic terrorist attack that happened at the Capitol and wanted to have a little bit more conversation about why there's so much conversation about white supremacy and how white folks felt about how white folks felt they could get into the Capitol in the way that they did, in a way that other people do not. We often discuss white supremacy and anti-blackness on this show, usually as a bullet point in a larger discussion. But today we're talking about it directly, and we've heard plenty of analysis about if those were black people, and that is 100% accurate. We want to get more under the surface on that, taking a look at how police, policy, politics, and government in general all have their roots in white supremacy and anti-blackness. I wanted to bring in someone who I knew would have a perspective on this that I know is writing a book about just this right now. Also, this person's an icon, a legend, and in one of those bullshit Hollywood ways that we reference someone, actually is a good friend of mine. Please welcome to the show, CNN political commentator Keith Boykin. Welcome to Fans High.
Hey, Jared. Hey, Travell.
Really happy to have you here. Travell.
Keith really is a legend, y'all, okay? Keith been around these streets in this game, National Black Justice Coalition, writing books and stuff, all of it. I just had to say that. So we have a new administration now, officially, and it's only hours old. We're wondering, kind of as a first question, how do you look at, you know, all of these issues as it relates to race in particular, about what we can expect over the next 4 years and beyond?
Well, we can expect a lot of different things from what we had over the last 4 years. The last 4 years was extraordinary. And so by extension, anything that happens now is going to be different from that. But I think what is unique is that for the past 4 years, we had for the first time in modern history, a white nationalist president who was openly committed to leading just his base, who had made no effort to try to reach out to black folk or brown people. He made token efforts to reach out to certain people who he already knew, or people who were close to him, the Lil Wayne's of the world and the Kanye West's of the world. But no attempt. Seriously, this guy, in 4 years as president, this has never happened before. Donald Trump never made a single visit to a black community for an open black event. It's never happened before in modern history. Never once. He's the first president since, I think, Grover Cleveland never to even speak to the NAACP as president. So clearly when people say, oh yeah, but he's friends with Jim Brown or somebody like that, it's like one celebrity doesn't account, or Herschel Walker or Tiger Woods, that doesn't account for, excuse, everything else that you're doing on the other end. And so in some respects, Biden has it easy. In some respects, he has it really difficult. He has it easy because almost anything he does is going to be better than what Trump did. Because, I mean, if you go back and look at Ronald Reagan and George Bush and George W. Bush, all presidents I didn't agree with, compared to Trump, they look like angels, and none of them were angels. And I think that, so in that sense, Biden has an opportunity to sort of set things in a positive direction, because anything he does will be better. On the other hand, because the expectations are so high and the need is so great, the challenges are so enormous. I think it's going to be a very difficult time for the next 4 years. This racial justice moment that people were talking about, they were calling a reckoning last year. I don't agree with that term. That has left our country with a lot of unresolved issues. We have these four major crises that Joe Biden as president is inheriting. We have this coronavirus crisis. We have an economic crisis. We have a racial justice crisis. We have a democracy crisis. And in each issue, the central core problem is race. I mean, the people who have been most victimized by this are people who look like us, black and brown people. And that's something that needs to be discussed. And needs to be addressed. It needs to be resolved. I thought Joe Biden made a couple of very interesting comments today. One I want to talk about. Two I want to talk about. One is he said, this uncivil war must end. And I don't know how he's planning on doing that because our country is so divided, but I think that's very important. But the other thing he said, and I don't remember the exact quote because I didn't write it down, but I tweeted about it earlier, was something to the effect of the idea that the old days of white supremacy or something along those lines have to come to an end. I need to find that quote so I can be exact about that. And I thought that was remarkable. Mm-hmm. You want to say? Do you remember what the quote was, Jared?
I actually kind of noted that moment as well, because I don't know, even Barack Obama, I don't think we've heard a president address white supremacy in their inaugural address. But I think that in this moment that we're in right now, you can't not address it if you're Joe Biden, with a black vice president and everything that we've been going through. And so as we kind of get into this conversation a little bit more, I would love for you, first of all, because I know that you're writing a book about race in America. Can we talk about what the name of the book is? Can I say it?
Sure. But let me just say I found the quote. The quote from Joe Biden was, "The dream of justice for all will be deferred no longer." That's a strong statement, because, you know, the whole Langston Hughes quote about justice deferred, what happens to a dream that's deferred. For a president of the United States to say the dream of justice will no longer be deferred, that is a bold statement. That's something that no president has ever committed himself or herself to. And so I'm going to see if he's able to even try to even begin down that route. In answer to your question, Jared, the name of the book is Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. And the book is basically about what's going on right now in our country. Ever since Barack Obama was elected, white America has become aware of the fact that their majority is slipping away. A new census data came out in the past decade or so that showed that by the year 2044, whites will no longer be the majority of the population. When you have a black president elected, when you have a woman who gets more votes than the white supremacist who runs for president after him, when you have a black woman who's elected president, who's elected vice president, when you have marriage equality in all 50 states, when you start to have diversity in representation, the people of color and Latinos who are growing in population and size, when you start to see the Asian American community as the fastest growing community in the country, when you also recognize that white Christians are no longer a majority in this country, all of which is happening, you know, rapidly in the course of the recent years, the white patriarchal hegemony is starting to be very threatened by that. And in response to that threat, they're doing everything they can to stop that change. They're suppressing black votes. They're rigging the census to make sure that black and brown people aren't counted. They're gerrymandering congressional districts. They're holding on to the Electoral College and the Senate, both of which are anti-democratic institutions. They're denying legitimacy of presidential elections. They're willing to suspend democracy itself and even to storm the Capitol of the United States to deny the opportunity for democracy to advance. That's how determined they are to prevent this from happening. That's what's going on in America.
We've talked here on the show about the definition of what it means to be conservative and what it means to be progressive. And like, the diversification of a nation is not a conservative value, right? It is not a value that is steeped in and rooted in like wanting to protect exactly the status quo and keep it as it is and keep it from changing. While we're having this conversation, I would love for you to kind of to give us, how do you define white supremacy and what is its distinction from anti-blackness?
That's a good question. I think that, well, you know, I think you and I have had this discussion about racism before and who can be a racist in along the lines of Ibram X. Kendi's book, right? Did we talk about that? Is that you? I'm thinking about
it. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I don't really know that I have the definitive definition of white supremacy, anti-blackness, or racism. And so I'm going to give my current working definition. So I think people are free to disagree with these definitions. But I mean, I'm a literalist. So from my point of view, white supremacy is any set of beliefs or values which holds that white people are in a position that is and should be in a position that is superior to black people. And that could be something as extreme as being a member of the KKK, or it could be something as modest as just assuming that everything is okay and having a country where when 29% of the population is white male, that 99% of the presidents have been white men. I don't think that's okay. If you look at it from that perspective, I'd say virtually every one of our presidents has been a white supremacist at some level. But some have been more so than others. I mean, some are very overt about it. Thomas Jefferson obviously owned slaves. George Washington owned slaves. Andrew Jackson owned slaves and was a notorious quote-unquote Indian killer. Even Abraham Lincoln professed his belief in white supremacy repeatedly, both before he was president and as president. So it's not a new notion. Republicans and Democrats have espoused white supremacy. Woodrow Wilson famously was a president who segregated the U.S. Civil Service and first screened the racist film Birth of a Nation in the White House. Even Franklin Roosevelt, who was a liberal icon, was so much of a white supremacist that he refused to allow Jesse Owens to come and participate in the Olympic gold medal ceremony after Jesse Owens had just won gold medals in Nazi Germany, in Hitler's Nazi Germany at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. So white supremacy is ingrained in who we are as a country. When people talk about this is not who we are, this is not America, they clearly have no understanding of what American history is all about. American history was built on white supremacy. 55 white men get together in Philadelphia and create a document for white male property owners in particular. That was white supremacy. It wasn't. They weren't trying to let black people and brown people and other people have their rights. And even the idea of whiteness is something they created in order to perpetuate white supremacy. I mean, before they came to the colonies, before they came here, there was no sense of whiteness. You were Italian, or you were Asian, or you were or whatever country you're from. You were European or this or that, but you weren't white. Whiteness wasn't a thing until there was something to juxtapose it against. And so they created this thing called whiteness, and they created this racial bribe where they convinced poor white people, going back to Bacon's Rebellion in the 17th century, they convinced poor white people not to be aligned with poor black people and black slaves by giving them a slight bit of benefit. We'll treat you differently. We'll create this thing called whiteness, and we'll allow you to join into this club of whiteness as long as you don't associate with and you distance yourself from blackness. Oh, and in answer to your question, how does white supremacy differ from anti-blackness? I think you were asking. I don't know that I have the definitive answer on that. I guess I could give you a definition for each of these terms, and we can sort of talk about how they differentiate. I'd love to hear more of what you think about this. But I've never been one to sort of. And I know we disagree on this probably too. I've never been one to sort of get caught up in the differentiation of those terms, white supremacy, anti-blackness, racism. I think they're all problematic. And I know people say there's a difference between systemic racism and systematic racism. I think their problem is that we have people who believe that one group of people should be treated better than another group of people, regardless of which group of people it is. So I very much subscribe to Ibram X. Kendi's philosophy or interpretations of racism and anti-blackness and anti-racism. The idea that you can't simply be neutral. You have to be actively involved in doing something to stop racism, or else you're the beneficiary of it, you're perpetuating it. And I think that that is problematic as well.
As you were talking about, you know, Lincoln and Jefferson and Washington and the Founding Fathers and all of that, it got me thinking about the ways in which, as you said, like our political system, our entire government, right, is rooted in white supremacy. The foundation of it is white supremacy. And it gets me thinking a lot about even that quote that you mentioned from Biden talking about, you know, committing himself to, you know, not deferring justice any longer. But if the foundation of the entity, right, that he's trying to use as a means of not deferring justice any longer is rooted in white supremacy, I think about the ways in which how we as Black folks participate in these systems might be contributing, right, and proliferating and spreading that same white supremacist foundation that was there. And so my question for you is, like, you know, is there a world from your vantage point where we engage in these systems whose foundations are, you know, rooted in white supremacy, and we're not also participating in our own ultimate, you know, oppression or marginalization?
Well, that's the question. That's the question of liberation versus assimilation that has followed us throughout the 400 years of our existence here. Do we assimilate into this culture and try to make it work for us, or do we liberate ourselves and sort of create something of our own? I don't really think I like that sort of contrast between the two, because I think for most of us who are here, we've chosen to stay here and really don't really have much option of where else to go. But I do think you raise an important question about our own complicity in the systems that exist. And I like the fact you mentioned that Joe Biden quote, because I remember back 4 years ago when Hillary Clinton was running for president, and Michael Eric Dyson wrote a piece, I can't remember where it was, but he wrote a piece about Hillary Clinton that suggested that she could be more racially progressive than Barack Obama might be. And I thought it was kind of an interesting argument. I was a little skeptical at first, but I have to say this now. I really do think that Joe Biden could be a much more progressive president on race issues than Barack Obama was, for a number of reasons. One, because he has this white privilege that allows him to do things that a Black president couldn't do. Two, because the white people who are in charge may be less resistant to him doing this because he's white. Three, because he doesn't have the same sort of chip on his shoulder that Barack Obama had when he was president, or I don't know how to say chip on his shoulder, but sort of this sense that he knew he couldn't do so much. I remember when Obama mentioned Trayvon Martin, for example, and just said, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And white people went crazy and said, how dare you say that? That was crazy. You know, mm-hmm. And so Joe Biden has this ability to do things that maybe that Barack Obama couldn't. But the other reason why I think this is possible and important is because I read Obama's memoir a few weeks ago. And what struck me, and I think I shared this with Jarrett once, is that in so many instances where I disagreed with President Obama in the past, Joe Biden was actually agreeing with me on issue after issue. And I was surprised that Joe Biden was very distrustful of the military in a way that Barack Obama wasn't even. And Joe Biden didn't like the idea of being suckered into the delays on opening up gays in the military, for example, or the military trying to draw Obama into the wars here and there. And I feel much more confident about Joe Biden after reading Obama's book than I ever did before. Nothing Joe Biden said in the campaign — I didn't support Joe Biden during the primary — nothing he said during the campaign convinced me that he was going to be anywhere near a revolutionary president. And I'm still not saying he will be. But reading what I saw in Obama's book, it gave me a sense of confidence that he will probably be a more progressive president than Obama ever was on issues of race.
I think there's a lot of value in what you're saying, and I think it kind of touches on a conversation that we've had here multiple times about like the work of white folks in ending white supremacy and anti-blackness. And I think that it kind of speaks to the idea that like this is white folks' work, right? Like black people can help in if and when we want to, but like this is the work of white people to end this. I would love for you to be able to kind of unpack for people why there's so much attachment to Donald Trump, his rhetoric and his following, and why we see it as being white supremacist or why we see it as being white nationalist, and the ways that those things are so linked to Donald Trump. And not just like in the stand down kind of way, but like what was America's attachment to Donald Trump that was really rooted in whiteness?
Well, two things. First, to respond to the first part of your statement, I do think there is something for black people to do. And I'm actually writing about that in the book. I'm proposing three different things. One is that the white community, the white America has to atone for its sins. That's the first most important thing. They have to atone for the sins of slavery and race and racism and white supremacy. The second thing is that black America has to hold our leaders accountable, not just black leaders, but we have to hold the various parties accountable. We can't, I'm a Democrat, I'm a lifelong Democrat. We can't just elect Joe Biden and think that that's our job and forget about it for the next 4 years and think everything's going to be okay. We have to hold his feet to the fire just as we would a Republican president. And the third thing is that we have to commit ourselves as a nation to the principle of equality, not just equal opportunity, but equal outcomes. The idea that it's not good enough that you treat everybody equally if you still have these racial disparities that are frozen in place for decades, and they will continue to be frozen in place. If you give everybody $1,000 and white people already have $100,000, you're still making white people richer than black people are. You have to do something to ameliorate those differences. So those are the things I'm recommending in the book. But in answering your second question about Donald Trump in particular, I think this is something that innately, intuitively, that black people just knew from the beginning, from the very moment Donald Trump walked down that escalator, we knew this was a campaign of racism. And you and I and so many other people were saying this. We knew this even throughout his presidency. We knew that he was governing based on racism. Even before Charlottesville, even before the attacks on the NFL players, even before everything else, you know, the foolishness he did for 4 years. And white people continually deny that. Even a lot of white commentators, they sold us this lie that it was all about economic anxiety. And these people were so concerned about the loss of their jobs and the changing economic global economy and all this other stuff. You know, Bernie Sanders talks a lot about these things too. And I don't like it, actually. I like what Bernie Sanders says, but I don't like the idea that we as Democrats or progressives need to buy into trying to convince these racist white people to agree with us by bribing them with economic goodies. I mean, we're already doing enough, I think, as a party, I mean, to try to support the idea of equal opportunity and equal jobs, healthcare, educational and housing and environmental opportunities. So if people don't get it, the reason why they're not getting it is not because the Democratic Party isn't talking to them. It's because they're more attuned to, more connected to the racism. That's what connected people in the first place. If you ask people about 2016 and what was it they liked about Donald Trump, they weren't voting for him because of his trade policies. They weren't voting for him because of his economic policies, whatever they were. They weren't voting for him for any of the other reason other than the fact that he gave affirmation to whiteness. He gave power to white resentment in a way that no other president had been able to do in modern history. You know, Nixon started this with the Southern Strategy, with the law and order campaigns and going after the civil rights activists and the anti-war activists. Reagan continued it with his welfare queen preaching and speechifying. George H.W. Bush, the first George Bush in 1988, ran that racist campaign with Willie Horton Mad. The second George W. Bush claimed that he was going to be a kinder, gentler president. Then he started two wars with two brown countries and ignored the black people in the city of New Orleans. And we saw repeatedly that there was so much lip service that it actually fed into this myth that some people maintained that the parties were the same. And I don't think that the parties are the same. I mean, for the past 60 years, it's been very clear that one party has essentially given up on any effort to try to reach out to black people. And the other party hasn't done as much as it should, but at least it's starting to reach out and have more diversity. So the reason why white people are attracted to Donald Trump is because he embodies all those things that white people have wanted to say to black people. They've wanted to say to brown people. They've wanted to say to people who aren't like them for so many years, never got a chance to say. And he says them. He gives them license to say those things themselves. And you see people engage in that type of behavior, racially profiling people on the streets, attacking us for being who we are, screaming and yelling at us, refusing to comply with laws and rules that are designed for everyone because they don't believe that white supremacy should be challenged. This is the last gasp of white supremacy that is fighting for its existence right now. That's why this is the race against time, because they know that time is not on their side.
Well, and I think to that point, I think one of the places that we can really see it the most that stands out to me is when we look at evangelical Christians. And I want to be really clear when I say that, like, we're talking about white evangelical Christians, right?
Right.
Because they have been able to twist and conform and contort themselves to fit into Donald Trump in ways that are just unimaginable. When we think about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and even Joe Biden as people that were his predecessors and his opponents. But like, they've kind of still flocked to him and seen him as their leader in a way that is just completely inexplicable when we if we aren't considering white supremacy and like their attachment to their whiteness there.
You're exactly right. I remember seeing a poll in I think it was 2012 of white evangelicals, and they were asked whether they could still support a president if the president engaged in immoral activity. And overwhelmingly, they said no. In 2016, they conducted the same poll after Donald Trump had become the nominee for the party. And suddenly, those white evangelicals were perfectly fine supporting a president who engaged in immoral activity. I mean, that wasn't the most obvious example of the blatant hypocrisy of white evangelical Christianity. I don't know what was. But what we saw today was another manifestation of that. At what was happening in the sort of split screen moment this morning, where I woke up and I saw Donald Trump getting on a helicopter, then going to Joint Base Andrews, giving a speech at a pep rally, and then flying off in Air Force One as they were playing Frank Sinatra's My Way. Which is wild in itself. And then they cut away immediately after, and you see Joe Biden in church at Mass. When was the last time you ever saw Donald Trump go to church, other than the time when he held up that Bible upside down across the street from the White House after he tear gassed the protesters to make a point? And the idea that white people, white so-called evangelical Christians, actually defended this pussy-grabbing president and defended his immoral leadership. Excuse the hush money that he paid to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Excused all the lies, the 25,000 lies he told. Excuse the infidelity that he engaged in. Excuse the putting kids in cages. Excuse
the kids in cages that are still there. Yeah,
and the family separation and the cuts to programs that help the poor and the needy and the trying to take away health care to 20 million Americans and call themselves Christians. And then they have a man who actually goes to Mass repeatedly and goes to Mass on the day when he's being sworn in office, while the other guy hasn't been to church in years, and they still defend that. And it makes you realize that Christianity was a religion that was based on racism. Europeans brought this religion to us. It doesn't mean it has to stay that way, because black people have embraced it, but Christianity was a religion that was based on racism. You know, Frederick Douglass talks about how he would be whipped by his slave master, and the slave master would quote the Bible to him.
I think you tweeted something to the effect, and then Travell, I want to let you jump back in, but like, I think you tweeted something about this a couple of months ago. If you are a Christian, if you are a religious person who could support Donald Trump and not Barack Obama, your religion is white supremacy or something like that. Is that how it was?
That was like 2 or 3 years ago. That was, believe it or not, I think that was like the most popular tweet I ever tweeted. It came back up a couple months ago. I think that was the most popular tweet I ever tweeted. I think it was something like, if your faith allows you to believe that Donald Trump was a Christian and Barack Obama was not, your faith is white supremacy. And I don't remember. I think I had like 50,000 or 100,000 retweets or something from that one statement. I wasn't expecting such a response to that. But, you know, one other example I just want to mention real quickly. I've been reading the past few days. I can't wait to finish it now that Trump is no longer president. This book, The Prophets.
You just sent me this book.
I know. I sent this to you. Let me tell you, you need to have this guy on your show. This book is amazing. This is the best book I've ever read in my whole life. And I'm not even finished with it. This is talking about all these things I'm talking about. He's doing it in a novel, talking about a romance between two black men in the slave era. And everything I'm talking about, the racism, the sexism, the misogyny, he discusses in that book. So I think people are starting to finally have an awareness, a consciousness that these things need to be addressed. And hopefully audiences will start to pay attention to those issues.
That book is called The Prophets, and it's written by
Robert Jones Jr., The Prophets. I'm sorry, I didn't give it the proper plug. The Prophets by Robert yes. Jones Jr.
Robert Jones Jr., also known as Son of Baldwin right. online for the folks who are on Twitter. But that what you were just saying brings me, I think, to one of our last questions as we wrap up. You know, I was watching MSNBC at the end of the inauguration, and Joy Reid was, you know, talking about what she called mm-hmm. the new America and how this inauguration represented the new America, from J-Lo to the poet sister whose name flips my mind right now.
She was amazing. Yes.
Amanda Gorman. She was everything. That yellow yes, coat.
I saw yes. the yellow coat everything. And I was like, her black anyway. Mama or somebody was like, now you know how yellow is going to pop on that brown skin, girl. Amanda Gorman yes. was everything. Shout out to her. Yeah. yeah.
So good. But she kept talking about the new America and talking about race and diversity and all this other stuff in juxtaposition to, you know, the last 4 years. And she said something to the effect of, like, she hopes that the new America wins mm-hmm. the war, you know, in talking about the ways in which, you know, people are mad, you know, people are upset, people are trying to take over the Capitol. And I'm wondering for you, from your vantage point, like, is like, do you also similarly see what we're going through right now as like a war of sorts, whether it's a war of like ideology or a war of identity, particularly when we're talking about like the ways in which white supremacy has manifested itself, you know, particularly what last couple weeks in the Capitol takeover?
Yes, I do. And I found the passage I think you're referring to from Amanda Gorman's poem. I just want to read it real quickly. She says, being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it. That's powerful. I mean, that's what took place in our country just mm-hmm. 2 weeks ago on the same day, that they, rather than share the democracy, the power of this country, they would rather destroy it. They'd rather suspend democracy itself. Yes, we are in war. We are in a cold civil war. I like the fact that Joe Biden said today we must end this uncivil war. But I don't think that words alone are going to be sufficient. You know, I admire the fact that Joe Biden is trying to at least address these issues. But 74 million people voted for Donald Trump. After everything that they'd already seen over the past 4 years, after everything we've seen over the past 4 years. And that in itself is a disturbing statement, because those people don't just disappear when Trump flies away to Mar-a-Lago. They're going to be your neighbors. They're going to be your coworkers. They're going to be your police chiefs and city council members and firefighters and elected uh-huh. officials and other people and CEOs. These are people, National Guards members. These are people who have infiltrated every part of government. And I'm reminded of the show Watchmen, which I really enjoyed. The whole idea that white supremacists have infiltrated the police department. We saw that when the Capitol Police insurrection, but not only the police departments, they've infiltrated our government. White supremacists are part mm-hmm. of our business world, are part of our society. White supremacy is as American as baseball and apple pie. And I think it's time that we start acknowledging that instead of trying to pretend that America is blessed with some sort of, what is it, American exceptionalism that makes us different from every other country. Let's admit the problem so we can actually resolve the issue. The problem is we are a country that's built on racism and white supremacy. And until we recognize that, until we admit that and stop pretending that we're somehow better than every other country and start realizing that we have work to do, until we do that, we're never going to be able to fix the problem.
As we wrap up here, I'm thinking about so many different things, but I know I called you about this before, Keith. I was getting on a plane and I saw on Netflix, Pocahontas was on Netflix. This was a few years ago. I think I was leaving Detroit or something from maybe an NABJ conference. And I started watching Pocahontas because I just hadn't watched it in a long time. And I immediately started thinking like, oh my God, this is like the birth of white supremacy in America, right? Like, because you see these white people coming to these shores and they are talking about the savages of the indigenous folks here, right? And how they've got to tame the savages and like how that is like the beginning of what we saw here in America. And I'm also thinking about having spoken with you multiple times now over the last probably 4 or 5 years about like the Civil War that is surely coming. And saying to you that I feel like the real scary thing about the idea of this now is that we don't have the air quote benefit of a Mason-Dixon line. And that these people, as you were saying, are our police chiefs and they work in the fire department and they work as CEOs and they live next door to us and they are all over the place. As we go forward looking at this, and I also want to point out like the insurrection that we saw, right? 98% white people, right? Like, I mean, we saw a brother in the gallery and like a couple of others, but like generally speaking, these were all white people that were coming in there to storm the Capitol.
And what was he doing there anyway? He knows he's gonna go to jail.
And what was he doing there? Different conversation, but like, what were you doing, bro? Right?
Thank you.
But as we still kind of have this feeling, and I mean for people that think that we're over, you know, selling this idea that something is coming, look at Washington, D.C. today, right? Like, we have more troops in Washington, D.C. than we have in our wars abroad. As we are approaching this moment, whatever it will end up looking like, how are you thinking about what we have coming in the terms of some kind of a conflict that I've been calling the race war rather flippantly, but I also mean it?
Well, I think that it's inevitable, but I think that the chances of it happening immediately have been significantly reduced now that Trump has been temporarily marginalized. Hmm. And so that doesn't mean that it's gone forever. It just means that we've managed to isolate a particular cell for a moment and to put it aside and to sort of demobilize it. I don't remember what the military term is for how they do that, but I think it's not going to go away though, and that's what's problematic. You know, you mentioned Pocahontas, and I was thinking about that the idea of white supremacy starting from the beginning. When yesterday, on the last day of the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, puts out a tweet saying that America is not built on multiculturalism. Mike Pompeo, the descendant of Secretary of State and the descendant of Italian immigrants, saying that America is not built on multiculturalism. If it wasn't for multiculturalism, his ass wouldn't even be in Secretary of State. and of course this country is built on multiculturalism. This is about white supremacy refusing to share the riches of democracy with people who are different. Now it's the people who've been let in the door, and now they want to shut the door, slam the door so nobody else can come through. And these are people who came in and took the land away from somebody else. I hate when people say, well, you know, we're supposed to come and assimilate. People from other countries are supposed to come and assimilate. They're not supposed to bring their own culture. Like white people came to America from Europe and assimilated with the indigenous people here. The stunning hypocrisy that people can even fix their mouths to say things like that with no sense of awareness of their own history is what's so sad about where we are as a country. I hope if anything comes of this next 4 years is that we start to get people to think again. We have a lot of dumb people in our country. We have a lot of uninformed, ignorant people in our country, and I think Trump exposed them in a way that I don't think anybody else could have. And hopefully that we can start to value science again. We can start to value learning again and reading and arts and intelligence and things that used to be respected before a group of people tried to dumb these things down in order to appeal to the widest possible lowest common denominator. And so I think the only way we get out of this problem is if more people are informed, more people are educated, more people are exposed to new ideas, more people are exposed to people who are different from them. You know, in the LGBTQ community, there's an old traditional thinking that people who know LGBTQ people are less likely to hold homophobic ideas. And the reality is that everybody knows LGBTQ people, but not everybody realizes they know LGBTQ people. So that was the argument for years back in the 90s that people would say that this is the reason why people should come out, because it would help to reduce homophobia. Now, the reality is people knew black people for centuries and it didn't stop them from being discriminatory against us. But I think there is something to the idea that it makes it harder to demonize people when you have to live with them. You have to see them and you have to be exposed to them. That doesn't mean you're not going to have your hardcore racists and hardcore sexists and misogynists and homophobes and transphobes out there. We're going to continue to have that. But we have to do something to at least educate the people who are reachable and let them know that this kind of conduct is unacceptable. You can't support, vote, enable, or contribute to the white supremacy of someone like Donald Trump and then go about your business, go back to work, and pretend like everything's okay. You know, when Nick Sandman, the guy who had the Make America Great Again hat on back a few years ago at the Lincoln Memorial, I think it was, in Washington, D.C., when he was in front of the Native American, the indigenous man, and there was a big, huge hubbub because there was some confusion about what he was saying, and did he do something wrong? Was he insulting this Native American guy or whatever? I don't care, because in my opinion, just by wearing that hat, that Make America Great Again hat, that is an insult. It's an insult to me as a black person. It's an insult to indigenous people. It's an insult to every person who has suffered in this country for the past 240 years, the people who were in this country before that time, before it was the United States of America. The idea that you can make America great again is a suggestion you go back to some time in the past when black people and women and Native Americans and other people who were different and LGBTQIA people did not have those same basic rights. I don't want to go back to that. I don't know anybody who does want to go back to that. So the one thing I do like about the language that Biden uses, I don't know how he's going to take this, but I do like the idea of building back better. I don't like the idea of just going back to normalcy. We can't do that. We have to do something better than what we had before. And I don't know that it's going to be an easy thing to do, but I'm agree. Here for the struggle.
I don't know that it's going to be easy either. I do like the build back better than the America is back kind of language, because that doesn't inspire confidence. Keith's book is called Race Against Time, The Politics of a Darkening America. That's going to be coming out later this year, right?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you so much for being here. You can see Keith on CNN. You can find him on his website. You can follow him on his very vocal Twitter at Keith Boykin. Keith, we really appreciate you being a part of the conversation tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you, Jared.
Again, our thanks to Keith Boykin for being here. Coming up, why y'all hate us so much in listener feedback and our dishonorable mentions. As we go to break, we want to know what you think. What are your expectations going forward for America? Do you think things are going to get better? Or are you as concerned about the Civil War as I am? Tweet or post using the hashtag FanTyFam. We'll be jumping in, responding to your post on Twitter and on Instagram at FanTyPodcast. I want to know what you thought that we didn't touch on here in the show. We'll be right back.
Si se puede. Okay. Now, this is a phrase that I actually first learned when I was watching Gotta Kick It Up back in the day on the Disney Channel, all right? But in case you don't know what that means, okay? If you don't speak Spanish, okay, that means yes, we can, or something like that, okay? Wow. And I just learned it, or, you know, came across it again on Babbel, which is the number one selling language learning app, okay? Babbel is dedicated to making learning a new language fun and easy with 15-minute bite-sized lessons that you'll actually use. That you'll actually use in the real world, all right? Other language learning apps use AI for their lesson plans, but Babbel lessons were created by over 100 language experts. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, but also you could do French, you could do Italian, you you can do Germane as well. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. That way, you won't be sounding like me.
I was going to say that, but then I decided not to, so I'm glad that you did. Right now, when you purchase 3 months of Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of three. Just go to Babbel.com and use promo code FANTI. That's BABBEL.com, code FANTI, for an extra 3 months free. Babbel, language for life.
Welcome back, beautiful people. We're going to get into our listener feedback segment. This is your opportunity to tell us how much you love us or how much, you know, you don't. That's okay, too. I'm going to read an email that we got from Shannon responding to our Let's Talk About Sex episode from last week with the one and only Mykel Street. Okay. Shannon says, I'm sending this email into the void because I wanted to express how much I loved the most recent episode with Mykel discussing porn, queerness, and blackness. This was fun for me to listen to as a queer white woman to expand my perspective. One of the things that has left me with lots to think about is the comparative difference between the idea of learning about sex and intimacy as a queer man growing up with gay and sometimes straight porn, and hearing how much that shaped everyone's idea of queer possibility and the concept of sex. I wouldn't expect the panel to speak to a queer woman's perspective, although, you know, I keep telling y'all, I'm womanish, okay? Like, I'm not a woman, but okay. I'm every woman.
I'm not even touching that.
Just leave it, okay? Somebody will drag me forward. It's fine. Did find an issue with that not being part of the conversation, but it did leave me thinking about myself. In my experience, my comprehension is failing today, y'all. In my experience, the way that the most common lesbian and bi pornography featuring women is framed, there's often very little for me to see myself or be able to identify with, since its perspective is often forcefully the male gaze. I hadn't really considered before the discussion about this topic, about how as a young queer person seeking that knowledge about myself and my sexuality, I was instead taught more about a man's perspective on women having sex with women. That's what made it so neat to hear you folks talking about yours. So thanks for sharing that with us, your listeners.
I want to say, Shannon, I will, part of why, wow, how much, I don't know how much to share here, but I will say that but I think we all kind of talked about on the show last week that, like, porn to me, like, is not good if I don't believe them. Right. And I think that that is part of why even lesbian porn sometimes is not good, because it's still like directed by a man. It's done for men and things like that. But I would say, like, check out feminist porn. It is like porn that is for women, that is like for the female gaze. It's very interesting. And you might enjoy that. So get your life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to speak to what you're doing in your bedroom or on your couch or in your office or in your car, Shannon. You do what you need to do for you, honey. How you doing?
How are you doing?
But I think to one of Mykel's points last week, right, is that, you know, when you look at content, some of the content, right, prepared by sex workers today, particularly on a platform like OnlyFans, that vantage and that gaze is, for some folks, is consciously flipped. And so there are some folks out there that might, you know, for Shannon or for other, you know, queer women in particular, you know, looking to, you know, get your rocks off. How you doing?
Okay.
There are folks out there.
Well, I got a DM on Instagram from Danielle, and I wanted to reading part of it here.
Oh, so we're doing two white queer women today.
Yes, we are. Danielle says, love the DEI episode the other week. I've been out of work since April, and more than a handful of ex-colleagues reached out with job postings for leadership roles in diversity work. At my previous job, I was our culture director, and I expanded my role to encompass DEI work, including starting our first employee resource groups, or ERGs. I was flattered my colleagues would think of me as a leader in DEI, but I always felt uneasy about applying for dedicated DEI roles. I am white identifying, queer, cisgender woman, and my gut told me these positions should be reserved for people of color who experience firsthand the racist world we are trying to change. I say white identifying because I am half white and half Mexican, but due to my upbringing in an all-white culture, I've never aligned myself with my Latinx heritage. That's a whole different story. She goes on to say, so it was super validating when you said you feel white folks shouldn't be D&I leads, and to hear your guest speaker echoing that as well, citing the bad optics of a white person running DEI, I fully agree. My question to you is, can white folks be on a DEI team, not leadership position, but on the supporting team? Or do you feel all DEI work should be reserved for folks of color? Thank you as always. You two are the best. What do you think?
Well, yes, Danielle. At least one of us is the best. So thank you for saying that.
I knew that you were going to give me that, and I thank you. I appreciate it. What do you think?
Yes, because I'm here to uplift you, okay?
Shut up! Can you answer your question, please?
Okay, so yes, I do think that white folks can and should be on DEI teams. I do think that a lot of this work is, you know, to be quite honest, the work of white people, even in a corporate context. And I think it is at the same time also important that the leader be a person of color. And yeah, did I answer the question?
I think you did. I will say that I've been in conflict with myself about this because yes, I do think white people should be working in DEI. I think it's important for you to be there as a part of those teams. But I also recognize that I think there's a little bit of a conflict for me in the way that I feel about the idea of allyship. If you guys have heard the OK Allies, Let's Get Information episode, we talked about how white people should not be allies because it's their work, not ours, and we don't need them to come to our aid. We can come to theirs. Right. And so the challenge for me then is in the idea that black folks should lead the work, or black or brown folks and marginalized people should always be leading those positions, because I do think that they should be. I don't want to see a white person telling the black and brown people how to be more diverse and inclusive. And so I'm trying to figure out where I am on that spectrum, but it's an interesting thing.
I mean, I think ultimately, because let's be real, what we know to be true is that white folks and white identifying folks are going to continue to get these positions. All right. That's just what it is. OK. And so I think what's important is whether you are the leader of the team or you are just on the team, you still have to be conscious about the space that you are taking up. You still have to be make sure that you are not silencing any other voices, and that actually you are being intentional, right, about making sure that other voices in the room get heard in the same ways that your voice will get heard, right? Because I think about the ways in which it could be useful to have a white person on your team to tell the other white people in the company what they're fucking up on, right? And how, even though I'm the black person over DE&I, that can be unfortunately an adversarial relationship with a company, because I'm coming in and telling you you're wrong or you're doing it this way, and the ways in which a white person can potentially, right, be that intermediary. But I think it's all about being conscious, aware of yourself in that space, and making sure that you're only platforming and uplifting the voices of color and not, you know, further marginalizing them.
I think it is really important for you to be in there. And quite frankly, I love that you're asking yourself these questions, because I feel like a lot of white people don't even think to you know, interrogate that. So shout out to you, Danielle. Okay, let's get into our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories or people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out, either for their good or their stupid. I have a lot of shit to say this week. You want me to just jump in?
You always got a lot to say, but keep going.
That's not true. Shut up. You be lying.
Is it not? We literally have
lying.
A podcast. We but
you be lying. Anyway, okay. One of the things that I saw on Instagram that I loved was someone talking about how they were tired of always having to put in for black people when they're searching things on Pinterest, and like apparently someone started Melaninterest. So Melaninterest, which is like a Pinterest for people of color, for black people. And so I just thought that was a really cool thing, and it's available in your app store. It's Melaninterest. And oh, maybe that's how they say it. Melaninterest?
Melon interest. You said it already, babe. You did it.
Okay. So that. I love it.
I think this is cute. I'm not really into Pinterest. I feel like I should get me an account just because they banned just because they banned homie. So I could give them a little nod. But yeah, so shout out to Melon Interest. I wanna give a honorable mention first to the UPS delivery people who deliver the boxes and the packages to my house.
Okay. I don't like where this is going.
Well, anybody who's been paying attention to our social medias know that we did a little photo shoot of some sort, right, last week. I think I could say that.
You weren't supposed to, but it's fine.
Well, here we go. and I needed some outfits, some options, and I ended up buying 12 options.
You did?
And so I just wanted to shout out the UPS people because I know they were dropping a box at my door for like every day for 2 weeks. And I just wanted to say I see you and thank you.
I'm irritated with the folks at Topshop, Top Man, because two of the things that I bought still haven't shown up. So we will see. We will see. Okay. I want to shout out the Biden-Harris administration that is coming in. It is Tuesday as we record this portion of the show, and they just did this COVID memorial at the Reflecting Pool. And I thought that it was a great moment that we've not ever had from Donald Trump, whether it be about COVID or being about, you know, the Donald Trump never offering this country comfort in a time of grief or mourning. And I think that one of the things that we don't have enough appreciation for is that throughout these last 4 years, when we have had any kind of moment of tragedy, any kind of moment of, you know, great grief for this country, never once has Donald Trump gotten up in front of the country to make us feel better or to just say, like, I'm sorry that this happened and we'll get through this. That's never happened with Donald Trump. And Biden and Harris aren't even in the office yet, and they've already done that. So shout out to them.
Well, speaking of being in the middle of a pager, I wanted to give a dishonorable mention. I wanted to give a dishonorable mention to all you homos in particular and the rest of you hoes who went to the clubs during MLK weekend across
the country. That was a hard left turn. I didn't see.
I just don't understand what people aren't getting through their thick skulls. If you don't, I mean, listen, MLK weekend is a big weekend in most black cities, right? Yes. Typically. In Atlanta, that's where all the gays go, you know, baby, to dip it into it in the name of the dream, okay? And so they had their activities.
The
they had their activities this past weekend. Houston had some activities this past weekend. Bow Wow apparently was performing. And I just was like, you see the video come back from these places, and motherfuckers are literally in packed clubs.
With no masks.
Very few masks, if any, right? But like packed clubs. And I just like, what aren't y'all getting, okay? I don't understand. We are in the middle of a panhandle, okay? And the paper cup is not, you know, unwavering at this point, okay?
Listen, you deal with the pendulum, say how you want to.
Yes, pendulum, say.
I want to give a dishonorable mention to Wendy Williams. This past week on the show. Well, I mean, we're probably not supposed to say that we were going to have Wendy on the show. I'm not even going to mention that.
Well, we were trying to.
We were working on that, but I'm not even going to bring it up because it didn't happen, and it's fine. So we never talked about it. But I want to call out Wendy Williams because she actually would have been on this week. But on the show this week earlier, she had called out her brother for like all of like the scandalous things that he's been saying about her on social media, which I'd actually never heard of until she talked about it on the show. But what was frustrating to me was like the homophobia that came along with it, or like the implied homophobia. Because like as she's talking about her brother, she's like, you don't want me to talk about you. And like she keeps doing like the. And then she's like, I'm not doing it very well right now.
It's all right. You're a bad gay. You can't help it.
I can only do it when I'm not trying to do it. Anyway, but like she then talks about her dress. She's like, you like my dress, Tommy? Oh, he would love this kind of dress. And like she was doing all kinds of stuff. And it was just like, this is the shit that we were talking about in the episode. Like, I don't know what you're implying because you didn't say anything, but, like, you really, like, played with something there, and I didn't like that.
I haven't even seen the clip that you're talking about, but that's, like, par for the course, apparently.
It actually kind of made me grateful and frustrated that she wasn't on the show this week, because I thought to myself, like, we would definitely need to talk about whatever that was. But anyway, that does it for this edition of Fantai. If this conversation piqued your interest, I would say probably go back to either the Tired episode or the Newsroom Where It Happens episode, maybe. Check that out for more conversation around, like, race, white supremacy, and the ways that that shows up in everyday life.
As always, y'all can give us 5-star reviews on the iTunes if that's what you're listening to us at. If you always have a comment or a suggestion about this week's show or any other, you can tweet at us at Fantai Podcast or on the Instagram at Fantai Podcast as well. Make sure you use the hashtag FantaiFam.
You said hashtag twice, so someone is going to use the hashtag and then the word hashtag, and I'm going to fight them. My gut tells me it's either going to be Legal Sojourner or Chris Williams. I'm expecting that. You can send us an email at fantai@maximumfun.org. Our music is produced by Corice, that is Core.ece. You can get it wherever you get your Slayworthy audio. Our graphics and the photo shoot that we weren't supposed to talk about, that's coming up. You'll see that very soon. That is from Ash Wynn. Our producer this week is Jordan Callen. And Laura Swisher. Is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
Okay. You want to bring us back in for C?
You got to put your whole body in it. Okay.